My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing.
My name is Isla. I'm an alcoholic. I fell in love with this lady when I met her almost a year ago, and I am so excited to hear you share your experience, strength, and hope this evening. I love you, Susie.
My name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I, too, fell in love with this lady, and I married her 11 years ago.
Hi, I'm Tanya. I, too, fell in love with Susie. In May of 2010, it was 4 months after I had become sober and did not have a sponsor yet. And I attended a Saturday meeting in which I'd never seen her before. And she was there and speaking about a funeral that she had just attended of someone that had this horrible disease of alcoholism. And she spoke from the heart. I just remember thinking, you know, I want what she has. I know you guys will get a lot tonight out of what Susie has to share. You know, I found someone finally, a person who could walk me through the steps, and we both believed in the same higher power. It was an immediate feel, the nearness of our mutual creator. Her display of kindness, gentle, warm-hearted, loyal, and the epitome of serenity surrounding me. Something I needed so desperately. She spoke, and I listened closely as she spoke about the funeral and of a friend regarding the disease. She shared from the heart, and I knew that she had what she had I wanted. Susie is one that people are drawn to, not just because the fact that she's pretty, but she's pretty on the outside and also on the inside. You know, God brought her to me, and I am so thankful for her. She is seasoned an AA member and recovered from alcoholism. She's a woman of strength, wisdom, patience, and that shows great tenacity for her sponsees. I am so blessed that God brought her into my life. I thank Him every day for the disease and how Susie has helped me to become stronger. Since 2010, our sponsor-sponsee relationship has evolved into a beautiful friendship. We are all so lucky tonight to hear her story. I am honored to be a part of this evening. Thank you, Susie, for all that you have done to support me and being a double winner of this great program. I love you.
Wow. Never heard that before. That was sweet. Hi, everybody. My name's Susie, and I'm a sober alcoholic. And my sobriety date is the 4th of July, 2003. That's my day of independence, of emancipation, of freedom from the bondage of addiction. I think for me, the best part of the program is freedom, the word freedom. Happy and joyous is frosting on the cake on the side, but freedom for me is what gives me the greatest inner peace. I'm real nervous. I'm always nervous. Can't speak in front of crowds. I'd rather eat worms and throw up than to be here. But it is written, anyone who has survived a great test must tell their story. And so that's why I do this to service. I prayed to God. Actually, Tanya and I prayed tonight. Just so sweet, sister, sober sister to sober sister on my bed holding hands, that God would speak from my heart, not my ego tonight. And that He can just maybe, if just of some of my words tonight can enthuse a few of you, 2, 3, 5 of you tonight, with the joy of Alcoholics Anonymous, then God has done His work here tonight. I'm going to first share what it was like. We do what it's like. And I hear nowadays a lot of speakers jump right into solution. They say, I'm not going to give a drunk a log. But the more we get away from that structure, the newcomer has to relate to us. When I share in my story about I was as sick as you or sicker than you, then you can truly identify with me and know that there's hope. I'll share what God did for me. I do use the word God. The word God is used 134 times within the first 164 pages of our book. And finally, I'll share what it's like today with a complete psychic change. I tell my sponsees it's as if I've had a complete total lobotomy and a heart transplant. I'm a different person than when I came in here. After 28 years on vodka, I was dying of this fatal disease called alcoholism. Today, the only thing I suffer from is a poor memory, so I do have some notes here, forgive me, just in case I get totally lost in chronological order so I can keep you following. I can divide my life into three sets of 9 years. The first 9 years, alcohol worked well. Life was one big party. I partied every night, and it served me well. The next set of 9 years, I drank more. I got thirstier, and I drank to cope with life, with stress, to cope with life on life's terms. The next set of 9 years, I had no choice. I had crossed that line into the allergy, and the obsession had completely taken over. And I was living life, I was handicapped from living a normal life. Later, I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin as a Cheddarhead. I was born into a family that I believe was the most dysfunctional family on the planet. This was my perception. Clancy always talks about we have a dis-ease of perception, and I never got it until recent years. I had two problems growing up. The first one was my mom. She was mean-spirited, hypercritical all the time, devoid of affection. She never touched me, ever, 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 never touched me. I never touched her. And she was hyper-religious, so I grew up in the church, a holy roller church. It was church all the time. And I learned about a vague God, a God with a small g, somewhere far away, I don't know where, maybe up in the clouds, didn't know where he was, but I could only picture a God of wrath whose sole purpose was to condemn me with guilt, shame, and remorse. Imagine coming in Alcoholics Anonymous and discovering a new God, a bigger God. My God got 10 times bigger. I found here in these rooms a God of mercy and grace and unconditional love, a God who is omnipotent, all-powerful, omniscient, all-knowing, a God who is omnipresent by my side, not just by my side, even within me. I feel the spirit in me, and that empowers me. It got so much bigger. My spirituality through AA didn't think it would. I didn't plan on that. But it was in these rooms I learned it's all about relationship, not religion. And I did find a good church I like to go to, and I go there to worship, but I come to AA to serve God because I have a purpose here and He can use me. Back to my mother, she was my rock. She was my burdensome rock I carried for 49 years. I blamed her for all my problems, all my character defects, all my alcoholism, everything, until y'all taught me to drop the rock. The second problem within me growing up in my childhood was I was born with this strange gypsy spirit, a desire to run away. I always wanted to go, and I had this insatiable desire to travel and see the world, abnormally so. And that seed was planted by missionaries who would come to visit us from Brazil and China and parts of Africa. And my girlfriends would collect globes as I would collect My girlfriends would collect little dolls, and I would collect globes in my bedroom. It was all globes, and I'd spin them at night and dream, you know, of all the places that I was gonna visit when I grew up. My first drink was odd. It was in the fifth grade, I believe, and I was with the wild crowd always growing up, and my friends wanted to get drunk, and they were siphoning booze off their parents' bar. So we planned for Saturday, but in my parents' home, no alcohol was allowed. So I reached in the cupboard and I guzzled a bottle of red wine vinegar. And I thought, that'll get me drunk. But it didn't. But you see, it showed a propensity of severe alcoholism, which was to follow in later years. In high school, I was a heavy binge drinker. I drank anything, paint thinner, anything to get high. My friends would always say, give it to Susie, she'll drink anything. And I did all drugs across the board. Then I back then it was like mushrooms and hash and funny stuff, but I enjoyed tripping on bladder acid, but I loved vodka. That was my definite drug of choice. I became then, and into adulthood, a people pleaser to the extreme. I was like a chameleon lizard. I could change my colors instantly to match your personality so you'd like me. I hung with the jocks, the nerds, the cheerleaders, the artists, the potheads, even the special ed classes, anyone I could find who would like me. Later, after school, it was 1976, I became Miss Wisconsin, and it was a fun year to represent the state, and my father loved to come on appearances with me throughout that year, but my drinking really kicked up a notch, and during that year, I learned that it was proper etiquette to hide it, so I had it really under control. I remember one embarrassing moment at an appearance in Milwaukee at Rex May's Classic Races. I had to say something in front of 50,000 people, and I got there, and they had a trailer in the pit, and in my trailer was a case of champagne, and I popped open a bottle, and I drank it, and the bubbles went straight to my head nonstop, and it tingled everything, every cell in my body, and I looked to heaven and said, Lord, I'm drinking stars, and I popped another bottle, and I shot it like a Jägermeister. Oh, it went down smooth and tingling, and I popped another bottle and could hardly stand. But they escorted me to the stage, and I only had to say four words, gentlemen, start your engines. And instead, it came out one slurry word. Totally embarrassing. Alcohol never served me well. Later, I went to school, and then I got a career, and I had a good paying salary, but I had an itch to drink, an itch to run away, an itch to go. Something was itching me. Then one day, I heard two words, flight attendant. And I was gone. I moved to Miami and I went with Eastern Airlines, flew for them for 14 years like Isla did. And life had just begun, so I thought. But I did something different than any flight attendants did. I took leave of absence 6 months off a year, every year for 14 years. So I'd work 3 on, 3 months off. I was broke. I lived on boiled eggs and peanut butter, but I saw the world. I would just travel free on foreign carriers, jump seats around the world. I was obsessive. Aircrafts had become my higher power. No, God, don't need that. And my suitcase was my home. I didn't have one American friend. They were all foreigners. My goal was to get 100 different countries stamped in my passports to join the Century Club in L.A. And I was gone, and I traveled, and I was a fan of the third world. I only wanted places that challenged me with no plumbing, no electricity, no one spoke English. And my first trip alone abroad was to the Congo, Kinshasa, Zaire, alone with no money. And I could write a book on that. But crazy things that I did. And as a woman traveling the world alone for years, I had to depend on the kindness of strangers, and those strangers were always men, for some reason, expats who were men, and alcohol was always present wherever I went. And I learned to manipulate men, and I used men, that was my world. I went into two different periods of my life to shorten the story of my life, two different periods, and I call the first period my period of darkness. And what I did was I became very, very promiscuous because of alcohol. I would meet a man, fall totally in love with him day one, and I would drink to get drunk, to let my guard down, give him my body, mind, and soul. and then exit, then drink to cover up the guilt, shame, and remorse. And I did this over and over and over with many different men around the world. They never served me well, really. It was a temporary high. I thought, you know, they were my higher power, but it only led to self-loathing. And it wasn't sex addiction at all. It was love starvation. And the love starvation came, I blame my mother. It's you, Mom, you caused this. But you see, my vessel was empty. And the big book says, whenever we are disconnected from God, discontent can only be the result. And I didn't know how to fill this vessel, and I thought that would work. I got so sick of myself, and my drinking had doubled, tripled, kept going up, downhill. I just got fed up and said, I'm going to quit, and I'm going to go into this period of light. And I read the Bible, and I went to church, and I threw myself into volunteerism, both here and abroad. And I remember I was thinking through self-determination, self-will, self-discipline, self-knowledge, self-help books, everything. I'm going to fix me. I'm going to be a better woman no matter what. And I couldn't. I was powerless. I had some profound moments. I volunteered with America's Abroad for International Aid, and I would go around the world and pick up babies from Russia, China, and India and bring them back for medical care. And I had an opportunity one summer to work with Mother Teresa in Calcutta. It tells how old I am. And I went there and I worked in her House of the Dying. It was the last stop. People would come from all over, and they would come and we would wash their naked bodies and say, Jesus loves you. And I worked in her orphanage with hundreds upon hundreds of infants, toddlers, and children who were near death. Real starvation. And Mother Teresa used to say, the children, Susie, the difference is the children here in America cry because they have no shoes. But here they cry because they have no feet. And back then, the parents would sever a limb off the newborn infant to solicit more compassion for begging to therefore get more money so they could survive. It's illegal today, just like the caste system is supposed to be illegal today, but it still goes on all over India in the rural villages. But even in that holy and sacred environment with the mother and those nurses, I had to drink. So each day I smuggled in warm beer and hid it under my cot and would drink until I'd pass out. Time went on and I got married. I thought, that will fix me. That will fill my vessel up. But it didn't help. I married a man from London, England. We were married 21 years, and alcohol played a major role in our marriage. He collected fine wines, and I would drink them as fast as bottled waters, as soon as he would bring these $200 bottles home, and I would guzzle them. But the disease progressed, as it always will with all of us, and it went downhill, and there were many moments of what the book calls incomprehensible demoralization. Thousands upon thousands for me, embarrassing moments that range from the humorous to the horrendous. A humorous one I'll share was, there was some funny times, and one was I got a DUI, went down to Fulton Jail overnight, got out. Week later, I'm drinking at Hauk's, and it's near midnight, and I'm driving home, and a cop's on my tail, and I knew those blue lights were going to go on, and no way I could get another DUI, no way. And I pulled into this fancy mansion subdivision of Gavarni, and I pulled up into the garage, and I walked in the kitchen, and there was a man in his underwear eating a slice of pizza, and I said, hello. And he said, hello. And I said, I'm a very respectable East Cobb housewife, but I want you to know someone's following me. May I stand here? And he said, yes. But I'm trying to get from the kitchen to the living room to look out the window to see if the cop is walking up the steps, because then I'm really toasted. But I couldn't. I was trying to move and just like, where are you going? I'm trying to look out the window, and the wife comes out and yells at me, and I got to the window, and I saw the cop pulling away, and I said, well, never mind, bye-bye. And I left, and I got away scot-free. A horrid one I remember, this took place in Lima, Peru, in the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel, where I came out of a blackout completely naked. All I remember is the staff wrapping me in a sheet and taking me to the room. Still to this day, don't know what happened. Alcohol didn't serve me well. One day, Eastern Airlines closed, didn't it, Isla? And my world collapsed. And it was like a cruel joke the life had played on me. I thought I was like a flittering butterfly going here and here alone, countable to no one, seeing the world, no roots, doing what I wanted to do, and it's like they pulled off my wings and left me just to shrivel up and die on the ground. I had to fly. So I got hired with United Airlines and moved to Chicago. And after a few weeks, they fired me, packed up my stuff, and threw me on an airplane and fired me, and never to this day told me why. And I was so filled with anger and hatred and resentment against United Airlines. How could you do this to me? And it wasn't until years later when God says more will be revealed, and it was revealed to me through a step four, a thorough, rigorous honesty, self-analysis, discover and discard what it was. And it came to me that I always had half-gallon bottles of Barton's vodka in my closet, always, that I was chugging off of for those few weeks. And the maids who cleaned the room, of course, would know they had to report it. No way did United Airlines want to hire a drunk. So thank God, I had a reason and I could forgive them. When we see our part, it helps. We can forgive and let go. So I still wanted to travel, and I became a tour operator in 1989. I started Adventures for Singles, and I design trips and take groups around the world. For my clients, it's like their once-a-year vacation. They plan and plan, and it's their one trip, some far exotic place, and they have every right to party and blow it out. But me, I was leading all the groups, so I was with them partying right along. Year after year, month after month, trip after trip. For me, every night was like New Year's Eve. Just tie it on. And that's when it was really kicking in. By age 44, I had become a daily drinker. That means I couldn't go 24 hours without a drink. I never did. For about 5 years, I had to drink, even if I was vomiting with the flu. I still drank. Every cell in my body was crying out for alcohol just as equally as my lungs needed oxygen. That's how I would relate it. I have something in my book here by Baudelaire. It says this. This describes exactly how I drank. She drank not as an epicure, but barbariously, with a speed and dispatch uncontrolled, as if she were performing a homicidal function, as if she had to kill something inside herself, a worm that would not die. That's how I drank. I desperately tried different ways to quit drinking on my own without this program. The first I called revulsion theory. So I'd take my vodka and I'd put everything I could find in it in the refrigerator, soy sauce, mustard, milk, anything, steak sauce, and mix it all up. Didn't matter what it tasted like. My cells needed it. Then I tried a vitamin therapy. I knew I was really getting malnourished because it destroys vitamins, so I'd crush up massive amounts of vitamins and put it in my vodka and drink it. Well, this is healthy. Even at times towards the end, I would duct tape my mouth shut from 2 in the afternoon till 4 until that itch that needed to be scratched. I could do this when I was alone and I couldn't talk on the phone or do anything. Just keep the duct tape on. What else could I do? But I was starting to die then of malnourishment. I was trading booze for food. And I was a size 0 sometimes in children's clothes. And the neighbors, all the neighbor ladies were gossiping in my subdivision. She's an anorexic. No, she's bulimic. And I just would smile. I didn't care as long as they didn't call me an alcoholic. That would have been rude. So it was okay with me. The self-destruction of a slow death began with me in three different ways, and the first was physical. I had severe attacks of acute pancreatitis at night when I couldn't sleep, wouldn't go to a doctor because I knew what he was going to say. Rosacea of the skin, I had a big red bulbous nose, often oozing pus, yellow eyes, jaundice with mystery bruises all over my body from a compromised liver, shaky hands like a 95-year-old, couldn't hold a coffee, Isla, on the airplane, couldn't order a soup because I couldn't drink it. But worse was the chronic nausea. I always had to keep an airline burp bag in my purse because I was always nauseous. And physically, this disease robbed me of having children, of having a family. I knew in my heart no way I could go 9 months without a drink, not a chance. Nor did I want to birth a baby into this world with fetal alcohol syndrome. The second destruction was mental and emotional. I went into deep depression, I think because I had no purpose. And when we don't have a purpose, we have no will. I didn't know if I was living to drink or drinking to live, but I started isolating and I was engulfed in fear. The fear had nothing to do with dying. I didn't care if I died. The fear was living more, going to prison and not being able to drink. That was my greatest fear. In that late stage, I started hallucinating, and that's dangerous for a female alcoholic. I would walk my doggies in the woods, and the sticks would become snakes, and the bushes would become bears. And once on an aircraft, I had screamed out in front of the passengers that my jump seat had detached from the metal floor, and it was hallucination. The third and worst destruction that was killing me was the spiritual part. At that point, my heart had hardened, and I call it cardiac petrification, hard as a rock. I had no conscience. I had no care of right from wrong. Nothing mattered. My tears dried up. It was like gangrene of the soul. Die, not die. I don't even care. There's nothing in here. And my obsession of the mind, which we read about is alcohol, got to have it, when next, mine stopped. It switched to suicide. All I obsessed with was killing myself. Kill the disease before it kills me. Kill the disease before it kills me. Better to go out suicide than let the disease take me. And one night I pulled my Smith & Wesson from my bedside drawer and just about pulled the trigger. But by God's grace, I didn't for one reason, and that's because I didn't want blood to spill on our white carpet. But God had different plans, because just after this destruction, I was given three gifts. The gift of desperation I had gone through, then to come the gift of surrender, then to come the gift of willingness. One day, a miracle of intervention occurred for me. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, nothing, wouldn't hear, blocked it out even if someone told me, nothing. Didn't do computers, didn't want to read about it, nothing. I was taking a group on safari, long haul, Atlanta, Johannesburg, and sitting right across the airplane from me, God had placed an angel in human form named T-Bone. And that angel was sitting right across from me, and I was lusting after him. Now, this 17-hour nonstop flight, one drink an hour, trying to pace myself, I had 17 drinks. And I went into a complete blackout, and I crossed over the galley, and I went up to T-Bone, and I mounted his leg and started rubbing him. And I whispered to him, "Someday you're going to kiss me, but you're not going to touch my breasts," is what I said. And my hand slid up his baggy shorts, and I grabbed his frankenbeans. And incomprehensible demoralization in front of a whole aircraft of 400 passengers. I didn't know. There's a liquor cart parked there, and I grabbed two vodka minis, and I put them on our tray table. And I said, "Let's drink." And he said, "I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "Me too. Woohoo! Thank you, God in heaven." But I saw he had been reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, no, you don't understand. I just got sober. I'm newly sober. I'm in the program of AA. And I said, oh, hell no, this isn't going to work. So I grabbed a Bailey's and I gave him that. And I said, drink this. It doesn't count. It's like a liquid Snickers bar. It's like nothing in it. And he still didn't drink it. Well, God had lots of plans from planting that seed from that human angel in my life. And later I flew up to Chicago to meet him, and I was bombed. And he took me to 3 meetings, and the last day morning I was green, vomiting, sick as a dog. And he dragged me to the mustard seed meeting in Chicago. And from there he took me to the airport and dumped me off and said, get help. I needed that. Next morning I called central office, Helen. And I thought, maybe I could just have an itty-bitty drinking problem, a little bit, but not really. And she said, go to this church on Paper Mill, blah, blah, blah. And I go there on that Monday night at 8, and I couldn't get out of my car. I couldn't. And I just sat, and I cried and cried and cried. And this old-timer came and opened the door, and he said, I can't stop drinking for a lifetime. And he said, could you stop for an hour? I said, yeah, I can do that. And it was 100 degrees, and I had on a trench coat, a hat, and sunglasses, like I'm important. I went to the meeting, and the meeting was on honesty. And at the end, they said, any burning desires? And I said, yep, I have a burning desire. I'm going to drink scotch tonight because I have to sleep. And they said, keep coming back. And I went home that night, 4th of July, and that was my day of delivery. That's when I got it. I got the gift of surrender. I got on my knees and I cried out to God, take this cup from me or take my life now. I can't do it anymore. And it was the most earnest, genuine from my heart prayer. And I felt a warm rain of deliverance cover me. I don't know what it is. There's no words how to describe it, but I felt an inner peace I had never had ever in my life since birth. And I crawled into bed and I detoxed for 2.5 days, shivering, freezing under wool blankets. And on the third day, I rose like Jesus from the dead. I rose like a phoenix from the ashes. And I got up and I felt restored like never before physically. And I wanted to call Oprah and Dr. Phil, saying, this is awesome. And I went down in the basement, and I got all our fine liqueurs from around the world, even in the decanters, and I loaded them in the garage, and I put them in my red wagon, and I went up and down to my neighbors and said, free booze, and they took it, and they liked it. But I was free. And then a week later, I had to take a group on a wine cruise, all you could drink free wine cruise down the Rhine, 50 people, and some Marietta old-timers I heard were placing bets, $25, she'll never make it. And I went on that cruise, and we get on board, and the captain calls me for a reception because my group was half the boat, and calls me up to toast champagne. And I walked up, and he held it, and I pretended to sip. And I stepped down the stage and took it to the back for an orange juice. And then I went to my cabin, and I had 3 tools. I prayed. I prayed on my knees, cover me. I don't have the strength. You be here and hold my hand now. And I read the grapevine over and over. I had one. It's a meeting in print, and it saves me when I'm far and have no access to nothing. And I ate sweets. My body went into shock from lack of carbs. I had no idea the physical part of it. And I ate cakes. Literally, for dinner, I'd have cakes. I mean, the whole cake. Would you like a piece of cake? No, I'd like the cake, please. Every night, they made me a whole cake, like a birthday cake, and the group would just watch. Wow, you never ate sweets. That was great. But I was protected from that, and then I found a great sponsor named Leanne, and she took me through the steps that teach us to climb our way back up to dignity and honesty and integrity and self-esteem, where we get stronger and stronger. Things were great. I was flying on a pink cloud, and about 2.5 years later, I almost had a relapse. And I was taking a group to Australia. I had them on Air New Zealand. They bumped me to first class. The wine was flowing up both aisles around me. I could smell it. I was salivating. I wanted it. I was thirsty. And the flight attendant came over and said, "What would you like to drink?" And tears were pouring down my face, and I said, "Ginger ale." And we landed, and we got there, and it was chaos in the Sydney hotel. Bags were lost. People are ornery at me. Our motor coach was supposed to take us to welcome dinner at the opera restaurant. He wasn't there. He's an hour late. I'm calling. I'm screaming. He got in an accident off a bridge. We need another coach company. We get to the... there. Everybody's screaming. We get to the restaurant late. The owner's screaming, "How could you be late?" Then the group's screaming, "Susie, it's free, free booze, all the Fosters, all the wines, Australian wines, free." And I wanted to drink. I was so thirsty. I got to my room at 11 that night finally to unpack, and I opened the first top drawer, and it was a mini bar. That's how they do it there. And I picked up with my right hand a vodka mini, and I picked up with my left hand the phone. "Information, I need Sydney Central Office AA." And a man answered, and he said, I told him, I said, "I deserve this. You have no idea. I've been good 2.5 years, and I am going to drink this and everything." And he said, "No, you're not. You're going to do exactly what I'm going to tell you. Step 1, 2, and 3. 1, you're going to hang up the phone and call the front desk. 2, remove the bar tray. 2, you're going to say this prayer." This is, and he prayed a prayer. "You're going to say that. You're going to sleep like a baby, and you're going to meet me in the lobby at 6 a.m. You know, I did what I was told, that gift of willingness. I did all 3, and I slept like a baby. And I got up early, and I went down in the lobby, and there came Donald. Toothless, raggedy clothes, like Salvation Army. He had taken a bus to a bus to a bus to come into Sydney, Central Sydney, and walk me to an AA meeting in the business district of Sydney. And I cried. I didn't speak. I just needed to be in the fellowship. Wherever I go, there is the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous extended unto me, unto you, wherever you go. Today, what it's like, I live in a state of grace. Grace is my favorite word in the dictionary, meaning God's undeserved pardon, unmerited mercy. It's a complete mystery to me. I don't get it. Why do we and you get this gift of grace? I inked it on my arm. Grace. If I want to be anonymous, I say it's my dog's name. But I'm just blown away by grace. That's what it all is for me. All the promises have come true in my life, and promises keep coming true. Things I couldn't have even dreamed of. That character defect of lust has been removed, root and branch. Gone. I have eyes for only one man. That man who was placed in my life. Together we're married and we walk this program. We live the principles. We embrace Alcoholics Anonymous as the foundation of our marriage. My God, my promises. He restored me from the insanity of my childhood and all this perception. In 2008, I was called to Madison to a hospice. My mother lay dying. And I touched her. For the first time, I touched her. And I held her hands for the first time. And I saw in her a little girl who was growing up in the Great Depression. And I saw in her all the service she had done to me as a mother, dressing me well and home-cooked meals every day. Isn't that worth something? And I saw... then it was like revealed. I saw my part. I was such a rebel to the extreme. I was self-centered, self-seeking. I was dishonest in every way. And I was flooded with compassion. All was forgiven. And there was a spirit of forgiveness that filled that room. And I know that when she passed, as I was rubbing my fingers through her hair, that all was well, and that program gave that to me. Today I focus on just 2 things. Serenity, because I'm just tired of drama. I really treasure a quiet life. And maintenance, I have to maintain it. And as we know the basic things we do, I go to meetings. I go to meetings around the world. I've been to the most northern meeting in the Arctic Circle, Lapland, and the most southern meeting in Antarctica. But the coolest meeting I went to was in Hanoi. We flew there, jet-lagged, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, ornery. And Terry said, we got to go to a meeting. And I said, oh, hell no. Yeah, we're going to a meeting. Got to go to a meeting. Got to go to a meeting. My eyeballs were crossing. I was so tired, and we couldn't find it. We're driving in a scooter all over, and it's behind a house. No, that house. No, behind that gate, in that courtyard. Oh, my gosh, and we get there, and there's two people, a man and a woman. Are you kidding? Thanks. Get all dressed, two people. Oh, boy, whoop-de-doo. How selfish. There was a young woman there in Hanoi, Vietnam, who had just got out of Ridgeview, moved to Hanoi, desperate to talk to a woman in English, desperate to meet someone recovered, desperate for a sponsor. I pray because I believe in the power of prayer. I talk to God, I listen to God, and I wait. An answer always comes. It's either, yes, my child, I like that, or no, or not now, later, soon enough, or how could you ask such a crazy question? But there's always an answer. Finally, I give it away to keep it. My greatest joy in the program is step 12. It's the magical paradox. I don't get it. The more I give away, the more my vessel fills up. How does that work? How does grace work? How does this work? It's overflowing the more I give away. Each sponsee is a gift. Each sponsee is as different, unique as a snowflake. Each sponsee I can't help but fall in love with. They are my dopamine. Because they're my purpose. We, each of us in this room, are commissioned with the most noble purpose on earth. What a gift. God commissions us with our experience. We have experience to help another who's suffering just as we did, to help them. Others don't have that. How awesome. And I look at AA as this great, big, beautiful garden, and God gives us all these seeds, countless seeds to sow. And we prep our soil. We till it with the steps, and we work it, and we fertilize it with the principles and hope. And we sow some seeds, and some don't take root. Some take a little root, a couple inches, and they grow up. And a month later, they turn to weeds and die. But many others take root, and they grow deeper and deeper roots, and they shoot up, and they blossom towards the sunlight of the Spirit, and they spread that grace, that God's grace, as a fragrant garden to others. What a gift that is. I've got my high-tech clock here. I got 2 minutes. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm very, very grateful for that, to be in this program, because without my disease of alcoholism and AA, I would never have known such incredible spiritual growth. Where would I be? Would I just be going to a church? Would I have no God? Would I just be hanging with men? I would never be where I am today with a new brain and a new heart. We are the lucky ones. We get two lifetimes in one. The first lifetime in darkness, the second one lifetime in light. And that always ends. Whenever I talk with the scripture from the big, big book somewhere in the Old Testament, it says, behold, the old has indeed passed away, and all hath become new. For surely I will restore unto you that which the locust hath eaten. For that I'm grateful. Thank you for listening.
Susie, thank you so much. That was amazing. Tinsley is going to give out the chips for us.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And what a powerful story. Thank you so much. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer the white chip.
Stop.